Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be giving you an opportunity to test your astronomical knowledge as we talk with Neil Cummins. He is professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. He has contributed many articles to Astronomy Magazine and is the author of a newly published book, which is titled Heavenly Errors, and the subtitle is Misconceptions About the Real Nature of the Universe. It's published by the Columbia University Press. And the basic point is that a lot of people have ideas about, the planets and the stars and the solar system and how it works and basic sorts of things like black holes. They have ideas about these things that just aren't right. So the book is not only trying to take an opportunity to correct these errors, but also talk about, why it is that people seem to have ideas that just aren't correct. So as we talk with Neil Cummins, questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in. Questions, comments are certainly in order. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you're here where we are, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Cummins, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure, David.
We appreciate it very much. And maybe right away off, we could kind of give an illustration of what it is we're talking about here. And I think that in the book that you suggest that when you look at the things that people misunderstand, probably most of this has to do with our solar system, our immediate neighborhood here in the cosmos. And maybe let's take a very basic question that, and I have to admit that I think I'm not sure I have such a firm grasp on this one myself, but one of those basic questions that kids ask their parents or that we were supposed to have learned somewhere along the line, and that is, why is it that there are seasons? And and I mean, I know basically the answer, and it has to do with the fact that the Earth is tilted on its axis, but somehow it's still sort of puzzles me a little bit. And it's one of those things that often what people, if they give you an answer to their question, they give you a wrong answer, one that it sort of makes basic sense and yet is not right.
That's right. And that one is that we're closer to the sun during the summer and right. Farther away during the winter. And that doesn't work in part because half the world has one season at the same time. The other half has the opposite season, and you'd think that if we were closer and it's warmer, then the whole Earth should be warmer.
Mm-hmm.
So already the logic of that is suspect if you think about it long enough.
Yeah. Although it's appealing just in a very simple, it appeals to the simple straight-line reasoning that says, well, the closer you are to a heat source, mm-hmm. the warmer you're going to be. You move away, the cooler you're going to be. So, well, it must just be that sometimes we're closer to the sun and sometimes we're not. And apparently, in fact, there is a slight difference in the orbit of the Earth of how close we are to the sun. But it's so small, basically, that's not enough to make any difference.
You're absolutely right. It's millions of miles of difference, in fact. But the fact that we start at 93 million miles away from the sun, a few million mile change, doesn't make very much difference at all. When you then throw in the tilt of the Earth that you're talking about, what that basically means is that if you imagine the Earth's orbit around the sun, it orbits in a plane called the ecliptic, and the spin, the axis, the north-south poles of the Earth are not perpendicular to that plane, but they're tilted 23.5 degrees. And when you say that, or when I say that, the tilt of the Earth's axis affects the seasons. A lot of people say, "Aha! The side of the Earth that's tilted closer to the sun is closer, physically closer." Same thing about the fire.
Right.
And that's the cause of the seasons, and that's also not right.
Well, why is it that it's and maybe the reason, maybe the answer to the question, why is it hard to get, is that you really to understand it, you kind of have to have a little model. You have to have a physical representation, because it seems that, at least for me, in my head, it's sort of hard to get this. But if you have a little thing with some little balls, you know, and you actually physically demonstrate it, then suddenly it seems there's a kind of aha that you can say, oh, okay, now I get it. That when you try to just get this in your head, it somehow, or maybe again, I should speak for myself, it's hard to sort of get it in my head.
Oh, absolutely. Many people, most people perhaps, have a strong visual content in their in how they learn things, how they understand things. So if you can see it, you can visualize it. It makes a lot more sense than just hearing the words. But since we're on radio, let me try in 30 seconds to say the words. Because the Earth is tilted, there are times when, so let's take the North Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere, where we live, there are times when we're tilted in our hemisphere towards the sun. And the result of that, which you can see very well with the pictures, the result of that is that when the Northern Hemisphere of the Earth is tilted towards the sun is up in the sky longer, which is to say there are more daylight hours, than during the winter. And we all know that. I mean, experience is that right now during the summer, the days are longer. And there is a second component which people typically don't notice, but if you go out and look sometime, you will, that during the summertime, the sun also rises higher in the sky. In other words, if you look at noontime at winter, say in December, mm-hmm. compared to noontime in right now, you will see that at noontime, when the sun is highest in the sky, during the summer, it's very high in the sky, but during the winter, especially like here in Maine, even at noon, the sun does not get up very high. And those two things, the height of the sun in the sky and the amount of time that it's shining on us during the day, those are the two things that, when you add their effects, create the different seasons. When it's up longer and when it's high in the sky, the rays, the energy provided by the sun, much more intense mm-hmm. on the ground. And that energy provides the heat, which creates the summer. And when there isn't as much of it, when it's not shining as long in the sky and it's at a steep angle and therefore the rays aren't as concentrated here on Earth, then it doesn't heat the Earth as much. That's our winter.
So this is one of those things that I'm sure that everyone in school at some point got this, and probably more than once. And yet, why is it that it seems like, you know, if we went out on the street and did a survey, representative survey of adults, that so many people probably couldn't tell us, or they couldn't really, like I would say to you, oh yeah, it's because the Earth is tilted on its axis. But if then you sort of pressed me on exactly how that worked, then you'd find out pretty quick, well, I didn't really know. So, you know, why is it that it seems that either we don't really have a firm grasp on it, or that we retreat to this more basic kind of logic that says, oh, closer to the sun, hotter, further away, colder? I mean, is this a failure of our educational system, or is it somehow it's just something that, again, it's sort of, you kind of got to show people, and those teaching opportunities maybe don't come up, or they happened 20, 30 years ago for you and you haven't really thought about it since.
What you're saying are all pieces of the puzzle. There's one other that's really intrinsic to human nature that's very important in understanding why we learn and then forget things like this. And it is that in the process of growing up from childhood onward, we are creating through our experiences and our teachers and our parents a framework of understanding of how things work. And if that framework that we develop is initially constructed wrong, it's very hard to change. If I was taught, or if I concluded as a child that when I'm closer to the sun, I'm going to be hotter, then I could be taught that several times. And unless I internalize it by using it and have to face the inconsistencies with the closeness issue, the chances of my replacing it with the correct understanding permanently are very, very slim. It's a hard process to correct incorrect beliefs, and that's the real basic problem with. And you were right. If you go in the survey on the street, you will find many people, most people, will tell you what you said before. It's because of that inbuilt initial, it's called a conceptual framework, was constructed wrong. And there has that people are very comfortable with their original ideas, have a lot of trouble accepting incompatible information, and therefore go back to the old system unless mm-hmm. they're really forced to learn it for some other reason.
I suppose I guess one might take the cynical position on this and say, well, does it matter? Does it matter that we might go out and find that there were a lot of people who could not give us the correct answer to the question, why is it on here on the earth we have seasons? And not only that, why is it that we have seasons? Why is it that the seasons in the northern hemisphere are the flip side, the opposite of those in the southern hemisphere?
If all there was to life was the gee whiz effect, or I should say, if all there was to misconceptions was the gee whiz effect about astronomy, I think the short answer to your question is no, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But life is much more complicated than that, and there are so many things about both the natural world and interpersonal relationships and business and everything else that people have misconceptions about that this tip of the iceberg in astronomy is not all there is, and it is representative of a huge amount of incorrect information we have that can be a big problem. I'll give you an example that actually connects astronomy to everyday life. There was a concern and several Hollywood movies over the last few years about asteroid impacts.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And, I mean, if an asteroid or a big body from space hits us, it's not going to be a good thing.
It's not going to be pretty.
It's not going to be pretty.
No.
And therefore, you know, one is justified in saying, well, it's happened before. We have absolute evidence that it has, and it will happen again. So should we worry about it? Should we spend billions and billions of dollars building a space defense against asteroid impacts, for example? And the answer to that is based in part on understanding the likelihood. And the likelihood of impact sort of starts with that, what's it, the second Star Wars movie, with the Millennium Falcon flying through the asteroid belt?
That might was that the second first out of anyway yeah I'm with you it was Star Wars.
Yes, it was The Empire Strikes Back, I believe, was the movie.
Ah, okay.
And the construct they used was it made sense for the movie because the spacecraft had to avoid all of these asteroids flying near each other, and the bad guys were wiped out by them, etc., etc., etc. As a result of that movie, most, if not everyone on Earth who has seen it, believes that the asteroid belt and the concentration of asteroids in space is like in the movie. And if that were the case, then there would be so many of them that the likelihood of one coming in the relatively near future would be very high, which could then lead people to justify spending that money and, you know, changing the course of, you know, where our society is going as far as space development is concerned. The construct is absolutely wrong. The average separation between bodies in our solar system on the order of 2 to 3 million miles. The number that are crossing our Earth's path is very small, and the number of big ones that can do serious damage is smaller still, so much so that the typical time between major calamitous impacts is millions of years, and we're not there yet. I mean, it could happen. It could happen tomorrow that a big one will hit, and I will have been wrong. But the likelihood is so small that it doesn't make sense to invest all that money now when we have so many other things we can use it for. And there is an example of a connection between misconceptions about astronomy and the real world.
Hmm. Our guest is Neil Cummins. He is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. He's the author of What If the Moon Didn't Exist? He's contributed many articles to Astronomy magazine. He's also the author of a recently published book here that's titled Heavenly Errors, Misconceptions About the Real Nature of the Universe. It's published by the Columbia University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Do you think that media, movies particularly, that's the source of a lot of people's misunderstandings about the universe?
It is one of several. Don't get me wrong. I love good science fiction. I'm all for it. But the reality is that if you suspend your judgment, your critical judgment, to enjoy the movie, to get into the construct, and don't put it back up again in time, your logical and reasonable reasoning defenses, then yes, you can get a lot of incorrect information from movies. Cartoons for children, too, by the way. Remember the Roadrunner cartoons, where the fox goes charging off the end of the cliff,
mm-hmm.
comes to a screeching halt, looks down, back at the audience, and then falls? That's completely wrong. But if you talk to children, many children, most children, and ask them how things fall going off the edge of something, they'll go out, stop, and go down.
Huh.
So it starts in childhood and keeps on going through the media, you know, the popular movies and so on.
Perhaps we could talk about some other things. One of the things that I guess sticks in my head, and maybe, it goes somewhat connected to this idea of understanding how the Earth moves relative to other bodies, the sun in particular, has to do with the moon. Some people will know that the part of the moon that we see, we always see the same part. And we talk about the dark side being the backside, the side that we don't see here, you know, with the naked eye from Earth, the side that you're looking at. And then you ask the question, well, people got that idea, okay, we're always looking at the same part of the moon. Then you ask, does the moon rotate? And the answer to that question is, well, yes. Yes, it does. Then we come to, well, now wait a minute. Now, how can that be? If the moon is rotating, how come we always the same side of it is facing us?
You've actually raised two very interesting points. Let me answer your last one first. If you were to hold, don't do this while you're driving. But if you were to hold your hand at arm's length and put your palm facing you, call that the side of the moon that's facing the Earth. And then move your arm around your body so that the palm always faces you, which is what the moon does. The same face always faces us. Then the only way you can do that is if your hand, your palm, is rotating. And the rate at which your hand rotates is exactly equal to the rate at which your arm is moving around your body. And that, in fact, is what the moon does. It rotates once, what we would call a month, roughly speaking, once every 28 or so days. The same rate that it goes around the Earth, that's called its revolution around us, is equal to the rate that it rotates, and hence the same face always faces us all the time. And the other point you made was that the side of the moon that we don't see is called the dark side. Pink Floyd helped to propagate that myth. From their album. But in fact, when we see less than a full moon, which is most of the time, we are seeing part of the dark side. And when the moon is new, when we see it as a tiny crescent, we see almost all of the dark side. So the dark side of the moon is not the side opposite us. It's the side that the sun's light doesn't strike. We see as much of the dark side as of the lit side. And the correct way to put it would be the side that we never see is called the far side.
Ah, all right. Maybe not quite as poetic.
Quite.
But well, then, what if we could get out in a spacecraft, we could go off from the Earth, and we could go to have that perspective that we don't have from the Earth? If we could look at the far side, is it lit? Is it equal? Would it look to us like the side we see, or is it? Would it in fact appear not lit so brightly?
Depending, of course, on where you put your spacecraft,
yeah.
You will see the dark side in a phase exactly as we would see the near side in a phase, and the far side is lit exactly as much time as the near side, just on opposite times.
Ah.
In other words, when we see a full moon, big, bright ball in the sky, so to speak, and you take your spacecraft at that time and fly out to the other side, the far side, and look back, it's dark. When we see a new moon and you take your spacecraft out and look at the far side, it's a full moon.
It's full. Okay. We have a caller. Let's talk to this person in Hinckley on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yes, I am calling from Hinckley. I have a question. Everybody always talks about asteroids hitting the Earth, and my question is, what happens if an asteroid, say the size of the moon, were to near-miss the Earth? In other words, fly by at 8,000 miles or maybe even closer than that, but not hit the Earth. What would be... Sorry, I've got a Burlington Northern train going by.
Oh, that's okay.
What would be the effect on the Earth or the effects on the Earth if that were to happen?
Okay, first the good news is that there are no asteroids that big out there.
But, okay, that is good news.
Yeah, but allowing for the fact that there are massive bodies, especially out beyond Neptune, that many of which will eventually come in this way. Some big objects could pass really close to the Earth. So let me just very quickly answer your question by saying the gravitational pull of that body passing very close to the Earth would create enormous, enormous tides, not only in the oceans, but also in the land, which is to say there would be huge volcanic and earthquake events.
Uh-huh.
Which would ruin your whole day, and there would essentially be no place on Earth which would be immune from the effects while they're occurring.
Uh-huh.
The gravitational pull of the Earth back on that object, interestingly enough, at the distance you suggested,
right.
would be so great. The gravitational pull creates a tide on the passing body that body would literally be pulled apart into dust, and the Earth would then. Yeah, depending on various dynamics and so on, would eventually, or at least temporarily, have a ring, which would have been part of the debris of that object passing by, if it's as close as you suggested. After the passage, things would settle down, anarchy would reign, and eventually the world would get back together again.
I see. Could it also pull the Earth apart?
Not with that amount of mass. The mass of the moon is 181th. The mass of the Earth. That's not great enough to pull the Earth apart. It is great enough, as I said before, to do serious damage in tides and earthquakes and volcanic activity. But no, the Earth would eventually return to its, essentially round and
okay.
stable state.
Could I ask another question?
Sure.
I'm wondering if the sun were to turn into a supernova. What would happen to the planets? I mean, isn't the supernova when the sun or the star explodes, and if it had a solar system around it, what would happen to the planets?
The good news is that the sun is not going to ever supernova.
Okay.
It is going to expand, however, in about 5 billion years when its fuel runs out and various activities occur inside. The sun will expand. That expansion we'll make it larger and larger until essentially the outer layers are somewhere between Venus and the Earth, and then it may even grow larger. Using that scenario, since it is going to happen, it is entirely likely that given enough time, the friction between the sun's very thin outer layers and the Earth will cause the Earth's orbit to decay, and which means we'll spiral inward.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on, again, on the details of the thing, either the sun will expel its outer layers while we're spiraling inward. That expulsion is not called a supernova. It's called a planetary nebula.
Uh-huh.
Or if the friction is high enough, then we'll spiral in and completely disintegrate before the planetary nebula occurs.
Oh, okay.
Which would also ruin your whole day, but you got about 5 billion years, so...
Yeah, we won't be here.
Right.
In a hypothetical sense, if there was somewhere else in the universe a solar system and that star were to supernova, would that possibly ever launch those planets, like you know, send them on their way, like possibly careening through space?
Off the top of my head, no. The gravitational pull of that body would be counteracting the explosive repulsion. And my very best sort of off the back of the envelope calculation suggests that it would vaporize the planets instead.
Ah, okay.
Because that's the supernova are really powerful explosions. Happily, there will not be life. There will not be life on those planets because supernova occur so soon after the stars form.
Yeah.
Those planets would not have time to evolve life like ourselves.
Oh, I see. Well, thank you very much. Fascinating discussion.
All right. Thanks for the call.
My pleasure.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I guess I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Neil Cummins. He's professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. And if you're interested in reading some more about some of the basics about how the universe works, you might look for his book, which is titled Heavenly Errors, Misconceptions About the Real Nature of the Universe, published by Columbia University Press. And as we've discussed, it kind of is about the ideas that people have about the planets, the stars, the solar system, how things work, ideas that maybe we all have that, well, aren't quite right. Questions are welcome. We have several. We'll get right to them. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We also have toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Morris, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a question about the Earth. At the time of the large dinosaurs, could our gravity have been different?
Ah, an interesting question. The short answer is no. Gravity is caused by the amount of mass the Earth has. And in fact, the Earth is gaining mass all the time from infalling microscopic debris from space. But the amount that mass has changed in the past 65 billion years is very, very small, much, much, much less than a percent. And consequently, the mass that the Earth had, that the dinosaurs felt underneath them to pull them down, to give them weight, is essentially the same as it is now.
Well, thanks.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Let's go to another local caller here. This is line three. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions, at least, but I'll think of. One is, I'm wondering if what you tell your students about their notions about welcoming place space would be for travel, because I keep reading quite a lot of things that make it seem quite clear that it's a very extremely hostile place.
I happen to totally agree with you. And there are two elements in that, the short term and the long term. The short term in space, I have no doubt that most people I know that most people who have gone there, but most people who would go there would find it absolutely thrilling to experience something so profoundly different. It's fun to be able to, when you get over the nausea, it's fun to be able to float around. When the moon, for example, is developed for tourism, it will probably be a rush to be able to ski down one of the mountains on artificial snow and play like you would on vacation. However, any extended time in space has all kinds of problems. The body physically changes, responding to the lack of weight. Our bodies then start losing bone mass, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And after the initial thrill is over, days, weeks, months, I don't know, it's a very sterile place.
Yeah. I hope you continue having the courage to tell your students the truth rather than succumb to their fantasies. But my other question is, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about just how special it appears the Earth is. There's like a huge number of, or what seems like a huge number to me anyway, of facts that all point to the reality that this is such a delicately placed place for us to be that it's it really boggles the imagination that I could that we exist at all.
Well, let me address that by saying that there are also a mind-boggling number of possible places for planets like the Earth to exist. For example, we in the Milky Way galaxy have on the order of about 200 billion with a B stars, and there are, roughly speaking, 50 billion with a B galaxies, more or less similar, in the visible universe. It is absolutely true that the Earth is located at the right distance from the right kind of star, one that gives off the right energy and lasts long enough, so that life could evolve here. However, if you then try to ask, well, is it likely that there are other places around our galaxy, around the universe, that have similar scenario, similar situation? The short answer is yes. We haven't found them yet, but we have begun to find planets around other stars. And while I absolutely agree that the Earth is an absolutely wonderful place and wonderfully suited for life, I strongly suspect that there are others, and others even in our galaxy, which are suitably suited.
But that's a little bit like saying, if you find a grain of sand that, on a beach that maybe is actually made out of precious mineral, let's say a ruby, the size of a grain of sand, and you happen to find it on the beach, that, yeah, I'm sure there's another one like it, on the beach here someplace, but finding it would be really difficult, and even getting to it would be really difficult. It seems to be way beyond us. And then I believe you've written, haven't you, about how if the moon wasn't here, the Earth would could possibly tumble in space, and it's also strange that the moon happens to be just where it is, so that when there's an eclipse, we can see the corona, and I mean, there are a lot of facts like that, which are all kind of, when you finally sit back and look and think about it, it's really kind of spooky that we're here.
If you take them all one at a time, each of the things that exists is a reasonable part of the pieces that are needed to allow life on Earth to be as it is. If they weren't, for example, if the moon was not here, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here to discuss it. The chances of there being other worlds with the right credentials, so to speak, for life, I think is still extremely high, and I am perfectly comfortable with the scenario that the Earth formed as a part of a process which is going on throughout the universe all the time that requires no intervention other than the fact that the universe began in the first place.
Yeah, well, you're pretty optimistic then.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I guess one last thing, and I'll hang up. And another thing I remember is that if the Earth were much larger than it is, there'd be a lot of volcanic activity, which would tend to suppress life. If the Earth was much smaller than it is, we wouldn't have an atmosphere. And if the event that created the moon, for example, had been a bit larger, it could have, been a catastrophe. It's just mind-boggling, but thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, and just to carry, to go back for a moment to the analogy of the grains of sand on the beach, whether you would agree that that's appropriate in this, as the caller said, that, you know, if we find one grain of sand that's a ruby, we'd have to say, well, somewhere on this beach, there's another one. Certainly it is the case, what he said, that if there was the other grain, finding it, and if we decided we wanted to go there, now that still would be, we're talking about a difficult, given the interstellar distances we're talking about, the idea that even if we did discover that there was life someplace else, and then if we decided we want to go there, that technologically, as far as we, you know, with the rules we operate under right now, that would be a very difficult thing.
Absolutely so. And if one follows that one step further, it will take centuries, sort of a minimum, to get to any relatively nearby star. The nearest star is about 3.5 light years away, and unless we can travel close to the speed of light, which is technologically possible but financially very difficult, it's going to take an awful long time. It's going to take generations. And to get there would probability that the astronauts would not all die for a variety of reasons, would require physically an enormous spacecraft with a huge amount of redundancy. I mean, suppose you forgot to bring one medicine along, for example, or one element that was necessary for life, one of the ones that's just very trace but necessary. Unless you had the ways of dealing with these things, then you're not going to make it. And that would require a huge, enormous spacecraft. Possible, but as you pointed out, and I totally agree, very expensive and beyond our means right now.
Mm. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Neil Cummins from University of Maine. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana here for line number two. Hello.
Hi. Could I just comment on the last caller just before I ask my question? And I think to quantify it, what I've read is that for the Earth to accommodate life as it does, for that to have occurred, for the conditions necessary for life to be accommodated on Earth by accident, if it happened simply by random chance, the chance is one chance in about 10 to the 60th power. That is to say, to have the Earth be as fine-tuned as it is for life, so that life is possible on Earth, there's only one chance in 10 to the 60th power, one chance in one with 60 zeros after it, that would happen by accident.
Well, Professor Cummins, you want to
comment? Yes, I'd be glad to. I would completely and totally unequivocally disagree with your number. It turns out that the more the biologists find out about life, the more likely it is that life is ubiquitous throughout our galaxy, at least, if not the universe. There is now very strong evidence, not definitive by any means, but very strong evidence for life, that life already had to begun evolving on Mars before Mars dried up. And there is circumstantial evidence that life may exist underneath the surface of the moon Europa, and neither of those two places are particularly appealing to life as we know it, for us, for example. But for life to start and to evolve appears not to require the long odds of which you spoke.
David has had some other guests on who talked about life, and they read a different book. The idea I know that's given in the common literature is that all you have to do is have water and a moderate temperature on a planet, and watch out, life is going to appear all of a sudden. And that's not how life is at all. Life is so complex. We don't know any way of having life other than to have highly sequenced coding, that DNA, you know, DNA, it has to code, and then there has to be a mechanism for reading and carrying out the code, and then the proper materials have to be present exactly at the right place, exactly at the right time for the mechanism to work. That's where the probabilities get really high. But let me ask the question I was going to ask about black holes and gravity. In a black hole, gravity is so strong that light can't escape from its gravity field. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct so far.
Okay, since that gravity field stops light, and since the passage of time is relative to the speed of light, is it true that any gravity field that's strong enough to stop light will also stop the passage of time?
The short answer is, from our perspective out here, watching the black hole absorb the light, yes.
Yeah.
For example, suppose you had a black hole and that you sent in a probe emitting light, sending out pulses, something, whatever you like, and watched it fall in. What you would see is you would see it approaching the surface of, bad word, black holes don't have surfaces, the boundary of the black hole, and you would see it changing color. It would get redder and redder and redder, and you would hear the pulses slowing down until, in fact, when it got to the boundary called the event horizon, you would see it stop. It would, from your perspective far away, it would hover there, and it would stay there much longer than your lifetime because time has slowed down.
Yeah. Well, now, can any gravity, without stopping the speed of light, can gravity slow up the speed of light? You've got just enough gravity to slow the speed of light but not stop it.
No. What happens instead is that the wavelength of the light changes in a gravitational field.
I see.
Not the speed, the wavelength. And if you have enough gravity, you can actually make the wavelength so long it becomes infinite, and that particle of light, called a photon.
Well, then, how does gravity, if you have a strong gravity field, that does, however, have an effect on the rate that time passes, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Can you briefly explain that?
Yeah, what it does is it changes the wavelength of the light. In other words, if you have light of a certain color, it's oscillating up and down, or it's changing like a water wave. It has ripples, the light does. And if you put those ripples of light into a gravitational field, the rate that the light goes up and down changes, oscillates, slows. So the gravity does not change the speed. It changes the rate that the light oscillates. And different colors, as you probably know, mean that the light from those different objects is oscillating at different rates.
And the time will pass relatively more slowly as those oscillations change?
As far as we are concerned, far away, yes. As far as, suppose you went into a black hole and you wore your watch and you watched what would happen to you as you went down, you would see no change in time. You would be perfectly comfortable with time passing in its normal rate, even as you fell towards the black hole, until, of course, it pulled you apart. And
that's true, but if I then, however, was able to escape the black hole and come back to Earth, I would find out that the Earth had aged many more years than I had. In other words, the time would have passed on the Earth while it was passing much slower for me, wouldn't it?
Your statement is correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is Normal, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay. To go back to the moon in a probability situation, over the length of time that the moon has been revolving about the Earth, for us to see only one side of it, in other words, for it to have this exact rotational period that presents us with only one side of it,
mm-hmm.
What is the probability that would occur? Does that happen with any other satellites of other planets?
An excellent question. Virtually all the planets all the moons in the solar system have the same property, and there are over 60 of them. It's called synchronous rotation, by the way, and it occurred for our moon because when the moon was first formed, it was liquid, and the Earth created huge tides on it, and those tides essentially changed whatever the rotation was at the beginning. It certainly was not any reason to believe it was the same as it is today. Whatever the rotation of the moon was at the beginning, tides were created by the Earth on the molten rock of the moon, and those tides literally changed the rate that the moon was rotating, until it locked it into its present rotation rate. And in fact, the moon's the tides created by the moon on the Earth today are having the same effect. The Earth is slowing down about a thousandth of a second per century as a result of the tides created by the moon on us. So we've actually seen this here on Earth.
where the effect of the other body changes the rotation rate. And in the case of the moon, locked it into synchronous rotation.
So I do understand you. All long-term satellites of planets
mm-hmm.
have exactly the same property.
Yes. All of the big ones, you know, the big round ones like the moon. Absolutely.
But that means the satellites that are not round do not have that property?
Some of the smaller ones are tumbling. I honestly can't remember which off the top of my head, but it is not reasonable to expect that the smaller ones, a few miles across type, necessarily must have synchronous rotation.
Does Europa have that synchronous
rotation? Yes, it does.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll try one more. Paxton, line one. Hello.
Hi, fascinating topic and excellent guest today.
Thank you.
I was curious, going back to talking about 5 billion years from now when the sun expands, and about how much of the sky would that take up from someone standing on the Earth and looking up? I get this image of a giant sort of scary-looking ball.
In round numbers, it will be a giant scary-looking ball. The details are not well established. In other words, different calculations show different sizes of the sun when it gets that big, but it will be at least halfway half the sky. It will fill at least half the sky. And in fact, as it grows in its very latest last stage before the planetary nebula, it'll encompass the entire sky.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, I think we'll have to finish because we've come to the end of the time. There's a lot more in the book we mentioned, so if you're interested in these subjects, you might want to seek it out. It's titled Heavenly Errors, Misconceptions About the Real Nature of the Universe, and it's published by Columbia University Press. The author, Neil Cummins, he's professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. Professor Cummins, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.